This is an Australian Museum podcast. Welcome to Live Talks at the AM, recorded in front of a live audience at the Australian Museum in Sydney.
And pay my respects to the traditional owners of the land on which we're gathered, the Gadigal people, and to, from the bottom of my heart, affirm that this was and always will be Aboriginal land and that sovereignty was never ceded. My name is Randa Abdel Fattah. I'm a future fellow at Macquarie University, and I'm delighted to be here chairing today. I'm excited to introduce the fifth instalment of the Saturday Lecture Series, which has been curated by the Australian Museum in partnership with Macquarie University. My mother is actually Egyptian, my father is Palestinian, and I jumped at the opportunity to be here today, not because I have any expertise on Egyptology, although people sometimes make that assumption, just because you're Egyptian, but I have, of course, always been fascinated. But I did learn one incredible fact speaking with Candace, which is, and she's going to talk to us about colonial histories as part of her talk today. But my mother was only able to come to Australia because of the Whitlam government paring back the White Australia policy. And you're going to see how that connects with today's talk. But these events, we know, are not just events in a timeline. They have real impacts on people's lives, on the course of their lives, on the tangents and where they end up. And so for me, it's really incredible to be sitting here today in the Australian Museum talking about, Egypt's history and to be birthed by a mother who was here, you know, out of an accident of history and because her migration landed her here, because a White Australia policy had been, pared back. Before we get to our special guests, I want to talk you through the structure and shape of today. The lecture will go for around 40 minutes, and then immediately following, I'll return to the stage and I'll open up the floor to questions. We're recording the audio from today, so just bear that in mind, and the Q&A. And I want to take this opportunity now to introduce our amazing guest, Candace Richards. She's the assistant curator of the Nicholson Collection at Macquarie University and has been part of the Sydney University Museums team for more than 15 years. Candace's research interests bring together ancient world studies with contemporary museum practice to reevaluate how and why collections were formed and explore the ways archaeology and antiquities collections can offer new insights into human endeavour. And I love that. I'm just going to riff here, but I love that because it's not just some crusty, biography. It's somebody who's doing this work because it matters today, trying to connect how history can shape and help us live in a better world today. So that takes imagination, it takes creativity, it takes boldness and a revolutionary spirit, and I love that. Candace is an archaeologist interested in Mediterranean and Balkan archaeology and has worked on research and commercial excavations in Europe and Australia. So today's talk is going to be about, I'll let Candace explain that, but I want to give you just a bit of context before I forget at the end, that it is part of a series today. And there are other events coming up. The Gateway to Egypt series includes one that I'm excited to be talking to you about, which is on the 19th of April. And that is with Dr. Julia Hamilton and Sara Salah, who is a good friend of mine, whose Egyptian background as well, an amazing activist, lawyer, poet, for the Tomb Talk series. And at the end of today's session, I'll give you a bit more information about that. So without further ado, I'd love to welcome Candace to the stage.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Randa. That is like the most nicest, I think, introduction I've ever had. So thank you very, very much indeed. And I'm really excited to be able to come here today. Again, a little bit about me personally. Yes, I'm an archaeologist and I work in a museum as a curator, and I'm really fortunate to do that. But I think the Australian Museum actually plays a key role in why I do that. And you'll see at the very end of this talk today, when I think about the exhibition histories a little bit more, that this exhibition on Ramses, the Gold of the Pharaohs, isn't the first time the Australian Museum have hosted such fabulous travelling exhibitions. And they definitely hosted one in 1998 when I was just 12 years old. And I remember distinctly, I'm from the country and my parents drove all the way into the city just to take me to the exhibition here. And I remember distinctly lining up around the corner because it was before we had like timed entry. And so you had to like stand down the street for hours before you could get into the show. And I remember distinctly doing that as a very clearly impressionable 12-year-old because I somehow made this passion into a career, which I'm very, very fortunate for. So it means a lot to be able to be here at the Australian Museum and talk about my research and work because that little kernel of, I think, excitement has definitely blossomed. So thank you very much to the Australian Museum for having me today. So as Sanaranda said, one of my research interests working with the museum has come from a lot of the times when the general public asked me questions as a curator as to why Australia has collections of Egyptian antiquity. Why is this stuff here? Why is it interesting? And why are Australians fascinated and continue to be fascinated about the stories from Egyptian history in particular? And it kind of starts really in the kind of colonial Australia landscape. 1957 is an interesting year for Australia's connection to Egypt. If any of you came today up from Town Hall like I did, you would have passed by our fabulous obelisk just across the road in Hyde Park. Now, this obelisk, which was constructed in 1857, is actually a Sue event. I'm not sure anyone's actually made that connection as they walk past. It is a Sue event, guys. And you might be thinking, what the? Why? Why would you make a Sue event an obelisk? And this is in 1857, when colonial Australia is young, but obviously Australia itself is a very old landscape with lots of different people living across the entire landscape in different ways and communicating and sharing knowledge on this land. And just as Rhonda acknowledged today, we want to acknowledge that kind of ownership and custodianship of history. What's interesting about like colonial Australia is the fact that there was an assumption by the settlers here that there was no history in Australia, that they needed to bring history with them. And they needed to bring this idea, the ideas, especially from England in particular, to the way that they were going to construct the land, the way they were going to divide up the land, the way that they were going to have certain types of buildings constructed around circular quay, bank buildings, things like that, all made out of beautiful Australian sandstone. But one of the things they brought with them is Cleopatra's needles. Now, Cleopatra's needles is this fabulous idea where the French, when they first went to Egypt, kind of were excited by the history of the landscape that they were going down. And when Napoleon came to Egypt and fought off the Ottomans and constructed a war and was there for militaristic purposes, he actually brought with him a whole series of what he called savants, educated individuals who could scientifically record history and monuments as they went. And as they went down the Nile, they made these amazing drawings that became a publication in the late 1700s that was published first in French and then in English and kicked off this fascination with this magical, mystical land, as they continued to call it, these ancient monuments of one of, as they called it, the great civilizations of the past. And in doing so, it fetishized Egyptian history. It fetishized a particular type of pharaonic history and said, hey, we want a piece of that. And in wanting a piece of that, they especially were drawn to the obelisk. Now, the obelisk is this kind of monument, as I said. It's this massive, four-sided geometrical shape that sticks up out of the landscape and very kind of, you can see them from multiple places from afar. And the obelisks themselves became a symbol of Egyptian history, but they thought that they looked like great markers. You can see them from a mile away. And so they took several of them, called them Cleopatra's Needles, even though they had nothing to do with Queen Cleopatra. She just was one of the most famous of the pharaohs and the lineage and the queens at the time, and took them back to France and then some to England. And they weren't the first person to take obelisks from Egypt. The Romans famously came and took a series of obelisks from Egypt and constructed their own. And the ones that you see across the road here in Hyde Park in Sydney is not based on any kind of Australian relationship with Egypt directly, but is part of the importation of cultural heritage from England itself. And that English cultural heritage was already fused with lots of different kinds of obsessions with ancient Egypt. And on the front of the thing, I'm going to use this fabulous pointer, on the front here, as you can see, there are fabulous sphinxes that line the base of them. But when you actually get up close to them and have a look, you'll see that they've got a very unusual shape to them. And if you maybe go for a walk through the Botanic Gardens and hang out outside the Art Gallery of New South Wales, you can see some other sphinxes that are guardians and gates that are much more kind of beautiful, I would say, 19th century female faces with this gorgeous kind of voluptuousness to them. And it's this weird fusing of cultures that you often see here in Australia. The way that Australians pick up Egyptian cultural heritage has often got, it's far removed from the place of Egypt itself and wasn't made by Egyptians. It was made by these colonial settlers that had maybe seen it once in a book and tried to replicate what they remembered. And so definitely when you go and have a look, have a look at these sphinxes, I think you'll be pleasantly surprised at the Australian take on what a sphinx should look like. But 1857 is an interesting year because it's also the year that the Australian Museum kind of began its fabulous collections. Every year, the Australian Museum was the very first museum here in the colonial Australia. It was called the Colonial Museum at the time. And if you go back through the newspapers of the day, the Australian Museum used to print all of the acquisitions that they received. And you can see up here on the board where I've highlighted, that we have a portion of a mummy cloth from Thebes by Mrs. Clay. And this is the kinds of acquisitions that the first museums of Australia received. It was always bits and pieces, because you have to remember that colonialists and settlers who are coming here to set up a new life in the Australian continent are coming from England predominantly, and the journey itself is a massive trip. You have to pack up all of your belongings, get on a steamship, and it's whatever you can fit in your luggage. And so it's rare for kind of people to be able to bring massive amounts of material. And so it was, the first collections were individual, very small pieces of cultural heritage. And you can see my favourite one here, I'm just going to divert for a minute. One of the other things that was collected at the very last line here were two figures made from the cervical vertebrae of a horse by J.W. Tuck, and I need to do some research here to find out what that object is, because it sounds fascinating to me. But as you can see, if you have allowed a kind of a quick scan through this kind of list of objects, that these are curiosities. These are not scientifically collected individual objects. These are curios. These are fascinating things of far-off lands, of different types of specimens, of different types of species that were kind of given to the museum in its very kind of earliest beginnings. And what happens is that this changes quite quickly after with the development of the Nicholson Collection, which I am very fortunate to be a curator of today. The Nicholson Collection was set up, unlike the Australian Museum was set up as a natural history collection, it was set up with scientific kind of purpose, but kind of attracted all of these kind of unusual bits and pieces, curios, pieces of mummy cloth, vertebrae of horses. But the Nicholson Museum was established with an educational agenda. It was set up by Sir Charles Nicholson, who was the founder of the collection. In 1856 to 1858, he went from Australia to England and then went to Italy and Egypt, and quite specifically to try and gather as many materials as possible to begin a collection. The University of Sydney was founded in 1850, and it was thought that to be able to teach at the university and to teach the kind of breadth of history that was required at a university, it needed to have a collection from which to teach. And so it was modelled off the museums of the Ashmolean and the Fitzwilliam in Oxford and Cambridge universities, and he thought, well, I'm going to do the same for Sydney. And so on these research trips, he collected a whole range of things. From Egypt, he collected just over 400 objects in and of themselves, which ranged from pottery, mummy cloth, as we kind of already have had, mummified individuals, including their coffins. And this kind of image at the very front here, you can see the display of the coffin of Petty Ashiket, who is still on display in the Nicholson collection today. Statues, basically a whole range of materials that could teach from pre-dynastic Egypt, so before kind of around 5000 BCE, all the way through to the Roman period in the 4th century CE. And this kind of educational agenda means that he didn't collect lots and lots of examples of just one type of object. A lot of collectors, especially in Australia, that end up getting donated to museums, come from an individual who was obsessed. And an obsessed collector collects hundreds of the same thing over and over and over again in every kind of variety. And if anybody went to my grandparents' house, they would definitely understand that with their salt and pepper collection. Oh my gosh, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of examples of the same thing, but slightly different. Whereas an educational agenda is trying to get a breadth of material and get as much bang for his buck as possible is how I kind of like to describe it, because he was using his own finances that he built up here in the colony. He'd inherited a lot of money from his uncle. And he was using that as well as his political clout. He was the first speaker in the New South Wales Legislative Assembly to be able to kind of drive forth this collecting agenda. And what's interesting about the types of objects he collected and how they were displayed is that the museum, the objects from Egypt were not sent straight to Australia. They were actually sent to the British Museum first, where Nicholson had connections with the Egyptologists that were working there. And it was the Egyptologists of the British Museum who first described and created a catalogue of the collection. And they also did a lot of reconstruction. The reconstructions range from this kind of reconstruction, oh, I love it, over here, where this piece in particular, it's only his neck, his knees, and the platform that are authentic ancient Egyptian antiquity. The rest of it's all been reconstructed. On this piece of beautiful gold cartonnage, you can see that they've actually painted this fabulous backboard, and it's up here on display. This photo is from around 1900, and this one I took on my phone the other day. This one has this beautiful gold cartonnage, but it's only the cheek, the ear, and a part of the wig of the individual that's been kept, and they've actually been able to fill in the rest of it based on what they project the object to have been. This is based on obviously other examples, based on connections with other collector antiquities in the British Museum, but they've definitely taken some creative license with adding a few hieroglyphic details, which we can't know for sure would have been on this original piece. And then our final beautiful lady over here, it's actually her whole face that has been reconstructed. And it was reconstructed in this kind of 1858 to 1860 window before the collection was shipped from London to Australia. But the way that it has been shipped and put together is interesting, because when it was originally catalogued, it wasn't catalogued as a part of Egyptian antiquity. It wasn't catalogued to tell you the story of the Kingdom of Kush, which is where this is from. It wasn't catalogued to tell you the fact that this is a statue of maybe Shapunwapet III, or Amandrius III, who is the wife or daughter of King Taraqua. My apologies for my terrible pronunciation of all language, including English, by the way. So this one was reconstructed. It wasn't catalogued to be anything about Egyptian history. It was catalogued to be about biblical history. Egyptian history, especially at this time, wasn't foreign as people may have think it was. The great kind of scheme of Napoleon that kind of recorded all these monuments comes from the fact that Egypt is very heavily referenced throughout the Bible. There are stories of the great kings, and in fact, some of the stories that you might see in the exhibition here have links to different passages from the Bible. I'm not a biblical scholar, haven't read the whole thing, but the way that this was actually catalogued is related to these two passages from Isaiah and Kings. And it was about the kingdom of Cush and its role in the kind of government of Egypt at the time. But the way that she's been reconstructed is very interesting. So the kingdom of Cush is at the very kind of tip of the Nile, as you might think of it, as it goes through Africa, and is in today modern Sudan. And the way that her face has been reconstructed has got nothing to do with the way that Egyptians, and especially those of the Nubian Egyptian kings, the black kings as they call, are often called, would have represented themselves in their statuary. It is created quite specifically in a much more Africanized manner in the way that an 1850s Englishman might project her to look. And if you look closely at her face in the center here, you can see that her eyes are a bit different to each other, right? You can see that her this eye here is kind of this kind of very kind of hooded kind of appearance. And this one here is on a different angle and a different trajectory. And that's because, as you can see in the CT scan, that the plaster outline is what you can see in that ghosting kind of effect. And the light grey kind of model you can see is what survives of the original statue, because her whole face has been modelled over in plaster and recreated, but recreated with this very specific vision of what they anticipated her to look like, rather than how she would have represented herself, how the kings of Cush represented themselves, and how they fit into the kind of history of Egyptian art and antiquity. And so this whole thing is a very kind of interesting kind of concept of what we can think about when we think about Egyptian heritage in Australia. That the way, especially in this kind of very colonial period, the ideas that we were kind of given and received were very English ideas. They were very English ideas of how the world functioned, of how the world worked, and Egypt's place in it. And going to that point, the next kind of big driver of kind of collecting during this period, as I said, Nicholson himself collected several mummified individuals of ancient Egyptian legacy from different time frames, and they were not they were an interesting kind of component, but they weren't bought over individually. They weren't bought over to be fascinating relics to come and look at. It was part of this kind of full set of educational materials. Whereas these individuals that were shipped in the 1890s by Mr. Gotch had just gone and purchased himself a couple of mummies from ancient Egypt. And at the time, by the kind of 30-year kind of difference between Nicholson's collection and this incident that I'm going to run us through, in between these two kind of concepts, the kind of thirst for Egyptian antiquity had really started to kick off, especially back in England, and it was being reported on in the papers in Australia, and that's how most Australians would kind of get a sense of what was happening in England and in what was happening in Egypt and how these things are intersecting with each other. And what happens is he goes and buys two wrapped Egyptian individuals for the distinct purpose of bringing them to Australia and to unwrap them in front of a public audience. He thought that this kind of mummy unwrapping in a scientific way, and he was trying to find scientists quite specifically from different areas of medicine, of different areas of Egyptology, of different areas of history, to come on stage with him to unwrap these kind of individual mummies. And it was copying what was happening in England anyway, because a lot of people, unlike Sir Charles Nicholson, were going to Egypt, buying individual pieces, taking them back to England. Mummy unwrapping parties were relatively common occurrence in Victorian society. But what happens in this one in particular, and why I love this story so much, is that he decided to himself that this was going to be a popular thing and that the museums were going to acquire it afterwards. He was certain. Now, as a museum curator, we don't really love when people think that the museum has to have something, because it might not fit in the collecting agenda, it might not fit in your storeroom, it might not fit with the goals of the institution. But this one in particular is funny, because even though Mr. Gotch did go ahead with the mummy unwrapping party, but in a scientific way, of course, and did it on a stage in front of an audience and had people come, other newspaper reports besides this one that kind of you can all find on Trove, it's a real fun rabbit hole for a weekend if you're interested, report of the audience getting up and walking out because it was too boring. Because unwrapping the human remains of an ancient Egyptian person wasn't that it was disgusting, it was the fact that it was dull. I don't know what they were expecting to see when you think about this idea that you are unwrapping an actual person. This idea of mummies and the program the Australian Museum put together have kind of touched on the ethics of this in other ways, and my colleagues who I work with are all kind of really into this kind of ethical considerations and talking about it more publicly, so I won't harp on too much here. But the fact that people thought that it was a boring institution, that it was, I'm not interested in this, kind of says a lot about what these objects are. Because, yes, when an ancient Egyptian person is mummified, they are mummified to get into the afterlife. They're mummified with ceremonies, with 40 days kind of takes to kind of mummify an individual. They're placed into a coffin, a sarcophagus sometimes. They're placed into a tomb. If you're very wealthy, you might get lots and lots of stuff in your tomb to take into the afterlife. That is the interesting story. The context is the interesting story. The history is the interesting story. All the stuff that goes around this mummification process is an interesting story. But just unwrapping a person, yeah, it's boring and weird. But beyond just being weird, what ends up happening is that in Melbourne, they create this amazing kind of exhibition building. And I do apologize for the quality of this image because it's the only one. And I can't find it. And I've been trying to find this image in different places and I don't have a high resolution quality of it. So I do apologize. But I hope you can see some specific details here. Oh, that's because I'm doing the wrong thing. There we go. So here is the unwrapped individuals because they did go on display after that they were unwrapped. You've got some prints that are kind of framed and put together, and these are prints of landscapes of Egypt. Up here, you have a fake mural being created and made, and all of the paraphernalia around it, especially maybe if you've got a background in set design and prop making that you might do as part of exhibitions, you can see all this kind of tomb-like structures that were created to be the exhibition building itself. And by creating an exhibition, it was a relatively popular show at the time, from what I can understand from reading newspaper reports. People did kind of enjoy going, and then eventually the mummified individuals do become part of the museum's Victoria collection and are still remain there today. But as I was saying, like the other component of this, so there's this weird fascination kind of component. And the fascination component does go through the Egyptian mummification building. It does go through, like, oh, we're going to unwrap mummies. But the main way that Australian collections have been developed is with scientific discovery. Since around 1888, there was a kind of a new thing that was started in Egypt called the Egypt Exploration Society. It was created by a group of English individuals, kind of spearheaded by Amelia Edwards, who had gone down the Nile and thought, wow, these monuments, they're amazing. We need to help. Very white savior model. We need to help. And by help, they mean excavate and take. And what they do is they set up with the Egyptian government at the time, and at the, remember, this is at the time when the Egyptian government was under British rule, and so they set up rule with themselves, that they were allowed to split the finds. Basically, as you excavate, any material that you discover, you would leave half in the country and then take half back to your own homeland. Or you would take half back and split that half between your supporters. And so Sydney University becomes the first support of the Egypt Exploration Society. In the 1920s, it joins with the Australian Museum, who also supported the Egypt Exploration Society to create an Australian branch. And then Western Australia, Victoria, a whole range of collections in New Zealand, all basically sign up to basically a subscription service where you could get together some funds, help support the excavation discovery, and in return, you would receive fines. And the fines that you would get would come from excavated contexts. They would come with decent understanding of what these kind of materials are. And so for the Nicholson collection, what we received was a range of kind of amazing materials, largely like the ones that you can see here in this photograph. This photograph was taken, I keep hitting the wrong button again. This photograph here, these objects down this bottom piece, all come from the Egypt Exploration Society in 1901. From the beginning of this relationship, the Nicholson Museum acquired several hundreds and hundreds of items, maybe around up to 1,000 individual objects were ended up sent just to Sydney University. And other universities and museums, as I said, have many more material. And this is the main way that Egyptian kind of stuff gets into the country. And it comes from amazing excavations. And the Egypt Exploration Society still exists today. They're doing an amazing excavation, amazing archivist project to digitize all of their records. And what we're finding is an amazing array of photos that demonstrate exactly who the excavators were. Because at the time when this photo was taken on the right, on your right, this is in 1901, these objects are connected to Sir Flinders Petrie. Sir Flinders Petrie excavated these things. Sir Flinders Petrie was the director of excavation. Sir Flinders Petrie was the archaeologist who would wander around the site and record some things. It was mainly his wife that did a lot of that work too, and we don't hear enough about her. But we also don't hear enough about these fabulous individuals who we often don't know the names of. We don't know the names of the Egyptian people that worked alongside these excavators, the Egyptian people that were really important in this excavation discovery. The Egyptian people, and this is part of what the money went to. The money that was being sent from Sydney wasn't just for a portion of the fines. That money goes towards employing a whole range of archaeologists and a range of individuals. And one of the stories that's starting to come out as museums are now working with Egyptian participation in a lot of these projects, finding family lineages of excavations, finding people who after generation after generation after generation still work in the excavation industry and can trace their ancestors back to these very photos. And so the digitization project's a really important one because luckily some of the photos aren't just of the finds and of the excavations, but actually record who was excavating them and these brilliant faces. And I'm not a great judge of age, but there are definitely some children that are part of this excavation process. This is not all adults doing this work. There's a lot of kids involved in this as well. And the Nicholson collection, this is from the site of Tele Yehudia, and this fabulous coffin fragment is now in the Nicholson excavations, and it's from this excavation itself. The only remains and human remains that have come to the country as part of the excavation, kind of these excavation processes, is one human person called Chebbi the Elder, because he was buried with maybe his son, who's also named Chebbi, and so they've been called Chebbi the Elder and Chebbi the Younger to try and, you know, help distinguish who's who when people have the same name. And it was excavated by this fabulous kind of excavation that happened between Harvard in the 1920s, and a young Australian excavator, Alan Rowe, was part of the team. And he was secured this particular example for Museums Victoria. Alan Rowe was a really fascinating individual. He's the very first Australian to start publishing on Egyptology. When he moved out to Australia in the early 1900s, he brought with him a whole range of books, particularly catalogues and material like that from the British Museum, and used that to keep studying here in Australia. So he's kind of the very first Egyptologist of Australia, if that makes sense. Australia loves to kind of hold on to him and keep him, even though he only lived here for about 20 years or so, and then he bugger off. But he always maintained a relationship, especially with the state of Victoria, and secured the only kind of mummified remains that have provenance, that we know exactly where they come from. Because most of the collections, except for those found during this kind of Egypt Exploration Society and the remains of Chebbi himself, were found by other kinds of collectors. And this includes one of the most biggest groups, the Anzacs. Now, as I'm sure everyone is here very familiar with the Anzac story, it's something that, you know, we are taught quite a bit about, especially if you went through high school when I did, when the main history we learned was Anzac history. And the Anzac history, the interesting kind of component from the Egyptian perspective is the fact that, you know, Egypt was still part of the British Empire at this time, which means that the Allied forces used Egypt as a staging ground. They used Egypt as a place to put up hospitals, to put up, to train the very young men that were kind of coming over to participate in this war from Australia and New Zealand. And they also had a whole range of different kind of infrastructure placed around the pyramids themselves. And on the Giza Plateau, where you find the Great Pyramids and the Sphinx, was actually where the base camp, where the Mena base camp was stationed, and a lot of Australians lived during this period. They do get to have some fabulous battalion days out to go and explore the site. I think this is one of my favourite photos, and again, it's in the Museum Victoria collection, where you can see literally Anzacs just having a great time, climbing everywhere, climbing on the pyramids, and they did. They climbed all over the pyramids, and they left their names, and they left their graffiti, and there's some amazing projects about graffiti coming out, including the way the Anzacs inscribed themselves all over those places. And they weren't the first to do that. There's lots and lots of names. And if you're fortunate enough to visit the pyramids, you can see the kind of the passageways are lined with graffiti of people who have come and kind of come to that place over and over and over again. Please don't do that. Don't feel compelled to add, please. It is against the law. But it is a testament to kind of where the Anzacs were and kind of their engagement with Egyptian cultural heritage. And they obviously bought stuff. And in fact, Charles Bean, who wrote a guide for Australian soldiers who wanted to collect when they were in Egypt, mainly to tell them to be wary of fakes and forgeries that were rife on the market. If you went down to the bazaar, you could definitely find a whole range of artifacts for sale. James Donaldson up in Queensland has been researching a whole range of really fabulous collectors up there, especially soldier collectors, who collected this amazing array of Shabti figurines. Shabti are these kinds of little kind of figurines of individuals. They have spells on them. The spells come from the Book of the Dead series that allow that that figure to basically become an answerer, to help you in the afterlife and to become an active kind of participant. But there are lots and lots of fakes of these, and these are all fake examples that soldiers collected, believing they were buying real antiquity. However, the objects on the bottom here from the Nicholson collection are examples of real antiquity collected by soldiers and a nurse. And these, the reason why I think that Australians in particular were able, Australians in particular, graduates of the university in particular, were able to collect real antiquity was because of the examples from the Nicholson Museum. I'm just going to go back two slides. If you remember this kind of pottery that was on display in 1901, this was on display between 1901 and 1914, when we have a whole range of medical students coming through the museum and seeing Egyptian antiquity. And so the vessels here that are collected are actually from graduates of the University of Sydney who later in life in the 1950s donated them back to their alma mater, their university. And in doing so, I think that the Nicholson Museum itself has this weird influence because it taught people what to look for. And so they were able to buy pre-dynastic pottery. And I must say that it's super weird to buy pre-dynastic pottery. Like, it's not the kind of thing that people, the general public would know about unless you were educated in a museum environment. And so I think that there's some like this element of them coming and seeing this material, which is, I think, really interesting, the way that museums can affect collections over time, because this is like a 50-year difference between these two things. And this last one, the alabaster pot, is kind of one of my favourite stories to tell people, because this is a nurse who collected the item. But for the longest time in the museum records, we always thought it was her husband. And then we did some digging. And this F.S. Burnell, Frederick Burnell, who was an ABC reporter, never went to Egypt. He was a part of World War I, very famously, so you can go on Wikipedia and find out all about him. He was stationed to Papua New Guinea. So where the hell did this come from? And it turned out that his wife, under her maiden name, Smythe, rather than Burnell, served as a nurse. And she wrote this amazing collection of poetry when she served as a nurse during World War I. However, the collection of poetry, when a biography of kind of like female poets were made of World War I, said she died in 1936. She didn't die, she got married and changed her name. And by getting married and changing your name, this is how women get written out of history. Because it's really hard to connect these dots together, and thankfully with like online resources like, you know, Ancestry and those kinds of websites, you can start to piece together how people change their name nowadays. And I don't blame the people thinking that she died when she actually just got married, changed her name. So it's been a long time trying to find out who this collector was. And then the other side of things, so while we also have the Anzacs, we also have migrants coming to Australia. And these are the two big drivers for how materials come into museums, and especially still come into museums today. We have things like basically the Suez Canal, which opens in the late 1880s, starts taking more and more passengers in the early 1900s. And by opening the Suez Canal, the migration route from England to Australia went via the Suez. Before that date in the 1800s and the kind of settler period, to get to Australia, you had to go all the way down and around the Cape Corn of Africa. Whereas by opening up the Suez Canal, you actually shorten the trip by about 40 days, which is quite a lot on a ship, I would imagine. But what happens is you actually stop at the Suez, and so many people are able to get off the boat, they're able to go, they might spend a day in Egypt, come back, get back on the boat, and come to Australia. They would collect things like these fabulous mummy fake, again, this is a fake artifact type. What you see here is you've got real linens that would come probably from a mummified human. You've got these little tiny kind of shabti figurines and a whole range of faience beads that string them up together. So these are a whole series of strands. And even though every single component there is an antiquity, they've been restrung to create a fake version of a necklace that was sold to tourists as they came by. And that's partly because the kind of faience beads, you can get thousands upon thousands of those in one kind of gravesite alone. And so they're kind of plentiful, especially as you plough fields and things like that. This is the kind of material that kind of rises to the surface. And if you can collect these things together and create a fabulous shabti to sell, you could. Right? And these kinds of things come via people getting on and off ships, getting into the Suez Canal, coming to Australia. Most of the antiquities that they bring with them are these kinds of beautiful examples of kind of fake antiquities, but you can get some real antiquities, and this kind of Senseneb Shabti on the right here comes from an Australian migrant who actually moved from he was interned in Australia during World War I. He was a German citizen. Went to London, got this figurine as a weird kind of story from an auction house that shouldn't have been left in the cupboard but was left in a cupboard, and he had to give the originals back to the owner and went, oh, who's the owner? Oh, yeah, Lord Carnarvon, famously, who excavated Tutankhamun's tomb. And as a reward for returning these antiquities back to the estate of Lord Carnarvon, was given this shabti as a thank you. It then goes with the family to South Africa, and then his daughter inherits it, and she marries an Irish-Australian guy, moves back to Australia, moves to Adelaide, then her daughter moves to the Blue Mountains, who then calls us and says, hey, I've got this thing. And you can see how these kind of objects move around the world through migrants and through personal collecting and these individual stories. But as we were talking about at the very beginning, all of these things come during the White Australia policy. All of these objects, thousands upon thousands of objects, come without people. around, I think it was like in the 1870s or so, I might be getting my date wrong. I think that there were maybe, or 1900, there were around 400 Egyptians living in Australia. And that number doesn't change until after the White Australia policy becomes lifted following World War II. At the end of World War II, we think, oh, we actually need to import some people to Australia. That we're growing and we need to be a growing nation. How are we going to build our country without people? And so we start to let people in. We're targeted with who we let into this country. We started with especially Greeks and Italian migrants who come to Australia. And the first Egyptian migrants are actually a lot of Egyptian Greeks. This fabulous certificate identity that's kept in the museums, Victoria, because they have an amazing migration museum down in Victoria, comes from John Neomontis, who came because he was a Greek citizen living in Egypt, wasn't afforded Egyptian citizenship, and moved to Australia where an uncle had settled to set up a milk bar, and then comes and lives in Queensland. And it's this kind of storytelling that is really interesting, because without the people, how do we tell stories? Without the knowledge, how do we tell stories? And up until now, we've only been telling this kind of very colonial story, even all the way up to the 1970s. And it's only that kind of time frame in the 1970s when we start to see Egyptian exhibitions that are curated and brought to Egypt from Egypt. Bob Hawke famously goes to Egypt and sets up what is the very first touring exhibition called Gold of the Pharaohs in 1989. And today's exhibition is the legacy of those things coming to Australia. You can see which ones have been coming from Britain, which ones coming from especially the Rijksmuseum, and how many shows we've had from Cairo itself, and the stories and giving agency to Egyptian people to tell their own stories. What's interesting about these exhibitions, and this is the final note that I'll end on, is the fact that while we've been bringing these fabulous exhibitions to Australia, very few exhibitions have gone the other way. In the 1970s, there was a fabulous program set up to export and travel Aboriginal Australian artists in the 1970s and 80s around the world, including to Africa. And the first exhibition was of a fabulous Aboriginal Australian exhibition that went to Egypt. The second, as far as I can kind of work out, is this exhibition from Fashion Week with a range of Australian designers with this beautiful wedding dress designed by Robin Callaghan, who is called the Aboriginal Wedding Dress, symbolising her marriage to her cultural identity here, that was displayed in Cairo, Aswan and Alexandria. And the third is actually a historic photograph collection that was travelled to Egypt of World War I and World War II soldiers and what they did in the pyramids. And so it'll be interesting to see what happens in the future to see if we keep importing this kind of beautiful Egyptian culture into Australia, or if we can get some kind of two-way reciprocity going back. So yeah, that's where I'll end it for now.
Thank you so much, Candace. That was incredibly engaging. As true, I just want to say that what I really got out of that was the way that you just brilliantly brought to life questions around race, around age, child labour, around coloniality, around gender. And that's a lot to do in 40 minutes, because, and it's a real skill, and I think it really, again, speaks to the quality of work and the imagination and so many questions. I've got my own, but you really have inspired us with so much to think about today. So can we all, you know, you deserve a round of applause for that.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you.
Thank you to the Australian Museum for hosting. Thank you so much for your company this morning.
This has been an Australian Museum podcast.